Janie Lee Grace. Welcome to the Natural Health and Sobriety Show on UK Health Radio. My guest is Sam Delaney, and I love this book. It's just so great, Sam. Thank you for being so completely refreshing, talking about mental health and men's mental health. And it couldn't be more refreshing, really, could it, than your title, which is Sort Your Head Out, Mental Health Without All the Bollocks. I mean, that, you know, that's kind of it, isn't it, really? It does what it says on the tin.
Yeah, it does. So, yeah. A mate of mine convinced me to use that sort of subline. Without all the bollocks, because I'd use that a lot on my podcast, which is about mental health. And I said, oh no, publisher will never go for it. And he said, well, you know, never mind the bollocks. Sex Pistols was like over 40 years ago now.
Exactly.
He went, so I think the British public are all right with it. So I said, it is good because it's like, does what it says on the TV. And so I'm happy with it. But on some, when I've been on the BBC promoting it, for example, no one can say the full title. And so sometimes I think, oh, maybe I should have thought it through, but never mind.
No, I think it's good because we know what we're going to get from this book, basically, from that title, you know, and that's a good thing. And I'm guessing you're going to tell me that, particularly for guys, that really is a good thing. So let's just take you back then and just share a little bit of your dim and distant past and what led to all of this. Just tell us a little bit about you, kind of early days, as it were.
Okay, so I grew up as like the youngest of four brothers with a single parent family, quite a rough and tumble environment, lots of drinking and banter and football and all of that sort of stuff. And that was the sort of character that I kind of felt comfortable being, a kind of a Jack the Lad. And drink was always a big part of that. And I always say, like, I was part of the Lad Mag generation. I kind of went on to actually make a living out of working for them when I first started as a journalist. And that what that was about was taking nothing seriously, least of all yourself, right? Yeah. So the worst crime was to sort of take yourself remotely seriously. And so that meant no looking inwards, no reflection, get on with it, and there's no problem that can't be solved by a night out with the lads and a few pints. So I saw that kind of life as fairly benign and almost always enjoyable. But when I reached my late 30s, having never been always doing that thing when it came to drinking of comparing yourself to your peers, and I always say I was never in the top kind of elite members of the drinking club. I wasn't even in the follow-up, you know, to put it in football terms. I was not a Champions League drinker. I wasn't even a Europa League drinker. I was right down the pecking order amongst all of my drinking peers. But as I reached, so I never thought in comparison to other people that I had a problem. But when I got into my late 30s, I started to just feel really overwhelmed and overstretched by life. It was this sort of combined pressures of work life and family life and maintaining my sort of social life and the kind of image I projected within that. It was a lot, and it was no more than, you know, lots of men and women have to do, that's for sure. So I wasn't anything unusual. But what I didn't do, and I regret, is that I never felt able to tell anyone that I was starting to get extremely stressed, sometimes depressed, and often, almost always, extremely anxious all the time. Worrying,
so it was just
worrying,
the kind of mask that you were wearing, really.
Yeah, I hid behind the mask that I'd always worn, which had been pretty authentic for years. I had been a bit of a happy-go-lucky Jack the Lad. And then suddenly, something inside just clicked. And I think, in retrospect, it was just the exhaustion and the overwhelm of the responsibilities that I had taken on. As you do accumulate as you get older. And, you know, I wanted to be a fantastic dad. I wanted to be a great husband. I wanted to continue to be ambitious and hardworking in my career. And I wanted to carry on being a legend down the pub on a Saturday after the game. You know, I wanted all of those things. But it was too much, especially if you weren't really spending any time reflecting or taking care of yourself. So to cut a long story short, I guess what happened was all of these feelings built up inside. I was too ashamed to admit to them because I thought I'd sound like a whinger and a moaner. So I kept them inside. I thought I was the only one going through this kind of experience. So I was very negative about myself. I was full of shame. I was just ashamed. And I started to self-medicate using drink and drugs. And I was very secretive about it, i.e. you'd still see me in the pub having a laugh with the lads, but I wouldn't really seem out of the ordinary to anyone else. But I was also spending a lot of time on my own drinking in the day, taking drugs in the day, holding down a very responsible job, but getting pretty out of it on the sly, hiding it from everyone around me. And that went on for about 18 months to 2 years before I reached a point where I reached out for help and sought some therapy.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a couple of things in what you've just said. You know, number one, isn't it interesting how we kind of use that phrase, you know, I forget the exact phrase you use, but basically along the lines of, you know, I'm not good as the other lads if I can't hold my beer kind of thing. This kind of concept that we have to be able to drink copious amounts of toxic liquid before we're seen as cool. It's bonkers, isn't it? It's absolutely bonkers. The other thing that I think is really interesting, you know, reading the beginning of your book, you really I think stress that you didn't have an unhappy childhood. You know, you had your fair share of knocks and stuff as kids do, but you know, you made it clear that you felt loved. You know, your mum, that comes across quite clearly, actually, that you definitely felt loved as a kid. So just before we dig into all the other stuff, I'm just really interested. Have you ever kind of asked yourself what might have made the difference? If you see what I mean. So I suppose what I'm getting at is, you know, the essence of what we're saying is you didn't do any of that looking within, you know, because most of us don't. Blokes certainly don't, do they? So you didn't do any of that looking within or self-reflection, or you just allowed, you know, the stress just piled on and piled on and piled on. So what might have made the difference? Because in your case, it wasn't that there was massive trauma there. I mean, we know that there's trauma with a big T and trauma with a little T, but there wasn't that huge, massive childhood trauma that one might say, oh my God, it's obvious you need to go to counselling or whatever. So you never hit that place. So what might have made a difference for you?
I think that really one of the biggest points that I'm trying to make in this book is that all of us, all human beings, you know, have been through a lot of experiences, knocks, cuts, bruises along the way. And it's really important to sort of honor that and observe it and understand what has happened to you in your life.
Yeah.
And put aside this idea that the only people with the right to sort of seek help or feel pain are those who have had what, you know, we as a society would, you know, sort of categorize as serious massive trauma.
i.e.
sexual abuse,
or
the death of a parent at an early age, or etc. You know, a phrase that I heard once in group therapy that I was really sort of registered with me was, it's not the elephants that kill you, it's the ants.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
So the thing is, if you have something big, and in the end I had something big, which was an alcohol addiction and a drug addiction. Yeah. And that was in many ways a gift, which I'm sure is something that, you know, a lot of people say on this podcast. It was a gift because, you know, my story was, I was loved in my childhood, but my childhood was extremely chaotic. Right. Yes. So my dad left before I was even, you know, when I was a baby. So I don't remember. And we were kind of left in the lurch, and my mum really struggled to sort of hold it all together. And you know, we lived on a council estate and then in a sort of a little council house by the motorway. And my mum was always trying to work full time, so I was often home alone, and my brothers were quite rebellious. So although I never lacked love, and even my dad, who was absent, I knew he loved me. You know, I would see, he was a weekend sort of a dad, you know, so it wasn't like I felt unloved. I did feel out of place. I felt disconnected from him. My brothers were all older than me. I felt disconnected from them. There was not much stability. There was different boyfriends of my mum's coming in and out of the house. Yep. The house was a mad place. And so I think that inside I had a sort of a real kind of sense of constantly being on alert.
Yeah, like, yeah, exactly. You wouldn't feel safe, yeah.
I felt lonely and sort of unsafe, but I did feel loved. You know, I didn't feel that. Yeah. So that was the thing. So, and then there were small things along the way. And then if you combine that, those issues with the cultural conditioning I had as a lad, which is don't show any pain.
Emotion. Yeah.
Constantly pretend to be okay. Not just show that, it's not so much don't show emotion. It's like actually go out your way to show almost incessant positive, upbeat emotion. That was the person that I was and projected. And to be honest with you, I believed it myself for many years. I thought, oh, it's quite good. I see other people struggling and being sad, and sometimes I feel sorry for them, or sometimes I'm a bit sneering and judgy about them. But I'm lucky because I'm always having a laugh and making people laugh, and I'm laughing all the time.
Yeah.
And then like it all gets on top, which it does for anyone. And I suppose what I'm trying to say to any reader of my book is you're allowed to feel pain.
Yeah.
You're allowed to show yourself a little bit of kindness and sympathy, right?
Yeah.
You're allowed to sometimes look back on the little bits in your life that caused you pain, but that you covered up to yourself and others, and think, actually, I did quite well to get through that, you know.
Yeah.
And there's so many people, because trauma is a big word, and we're surrounded now more than ever by stories of people who have been through awful things more than I could ever imagine. That there's people in, and then there's other people, the lucky few, who might genuinely be able to maintain a level of contentment most of the time in their life. Although I think that those people are very rare.
Well, so do I,
But there's a big group in the middle of people who've just had the experience of being a human being, which is tough.
Yeah,
And if you don't acknowledge that, you're going to be pushed into the arms of something. And in my case, it was drinking drugs. With other people, it could be anything. You know, it could be relationships or eating or whatever. But eventually, if you're not actually confronting it and processing it, I believe you will be ripe and vulnerable to fall into some form of bad habit.
Absolutely.
To sort of try and distract yourself, you know.
Yeah, I totally agree. There's that phrase is exactly right, because, you know, it is, you know, the big trauma is huge, but, you know, but as you say, it's the little things, it's the ants, isn't it? And there's again, another lovely phrase in the work that I do with something called matrix re-imprinting, which sounds very fancy, and family constellations, is just this lovely phrase. It's not what happens to you, it's what you made it mean. You know, none of us can change those things that happen to us, big or small, but it's what we made it mean. And obviously when you were a kid, some things would have happened to you that you made mean something, you know, and certainly at some point you would have made a decision. Okay, I'm going to put a brave face on everything. I'm going to be Jack. I'm going to be Jack the Lad forever.
I can see now that I kind of was in the process of writing this book. I did sort of think quite a lot in detail about my my childhood when I was still at primary school.
Yeah.
And the sort of identities that I was caught between. So for instance, I had a very different identity at weekends with my dad to the one that I would have had at home with my mum and my brothers, right? I just literally, I almost spoke in a different voice, right? And I've actually found by speaking to other men who were from similar backgrounds, who had a dad who left, that it was very common to do that. You know, you sort of are trying to do these two different personas. And I was, you know, maybe I was at school, you're caught between being different types of bloke. Like, you know, I was reasonably smart at school. So particularly, you know, with things like English and art, the teachers would sort of praise me. And so on the one hand, I'd quite warm to that. But on the other hand, I kind of wanted to be a tearaway. I sort of wanted to be a bit of a rebel.
I want to be the rebel, yeah.
That fitted into a sort of a different kind of image I had, where I wanted to be sort of tough and rebellious, you know.
Yeah.
And so searching around for something, I think in the end, I actually made a conscious decision to think, in early adolescence, think, no, I'm going to be a lad, because they're funny and everyone, and they're charismatic, and nothing bothers them. And I think we all learn as kids as well to pretend to be okay.
Yeah, definitely.
It's really weird, because the older I get, the more I realize you pretend to be okay sometimes to please your parents.
Oh, God, I remember that. I remember
your parents are actually making you upset sometimes, or life's shit. Yeah. And they go, are you all right? And all you ever say to your parents is, I'm fine. Because I don't want to make you feel bad.
Yeah, I remember being really badly bullied when I was a kid. And was something going on actually outside my house. If I remember now, this vague memory of it was absolutely awful. But my overriding memory is that the only thing I could think of was I couldn't bear it if my parents heard. I couldn't bear them to have to feel the upset and shame. So I needed to carry it for them. You know, I wasn't even upset myself. It was just the absolute horror of them hearing it. Right.
Yeah.
That's what kids do, isn't it?
And your kid and your parent. And now as a parent, you know, I always am trying to make sure my kids are okay. And they often, and it's this weird thing where a kid will reassure you, and it should be the other way around.
Yeah, exactly. And children try to carry it for their parents.
Sometimes I see it. I see it with my own kids, and then I feel awful. I think they're trying to reassure me about the situation. Yeah. They don't want me to feel sad or worried.
Yeah, exactly.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. You don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it, defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
You know, what I was getting at when I was saying what might have made it different, I suppose this is exactly it, what we're talking about now, is if there's more awareness for kids, you know, about accepting and noticing emotions, it would change everything.
Yes, that's
wouldn't it?
That's
if we, if kids were allowed to feel a range of emotions, and you know what? We all have a whole range of emotions. They're not all fabulous. Sometimes we feel angry, sad, jealous, guilty, whatever the hell it is.
Yeah.
And you know what? It will pass. But we can sit with it. We can acknowledge it. We can share it. We can be open about it.
And it's not a failure to feel those things. I think when you put it like that, I kind of think, yeah, I think I probably thought that sadness or fear,
yes,
insecurity,
exactly,
shame, those were all failures. I was like, oh, I'm failing at life here, because I would look at other people who I'd sort of look up to. I suppose I'd look at my dad, and he would never, you know, it's a classic sort of dad, especially of his generation. You know, he's a really kind guy, my dad, but he would, you know, he carried himself with this thing that nothing bothered him. And that actually getting sad or being, his sort of point of view seemed to be getting sad or feeling low or any of those things was almost just like you were being irrational.
Yeah, sign of weakness.
And in his world, being irrational is like really like something to be ashamed of. If you're not, you know, so like there was no room for, well, yeah, but all emotions are kind of irrational, aren't they? That's the difference between your brain and your heart. Yeah. And you know, I don't blame him, because that was the way he'd probably been raised, right? Yeah. And actually, really, you end up feeling quite sorry for parents when you realize they're like that, the older generation, because you think, oh, that's just part of how they were raised, and they can't. And I look at my parents' lives, and to be honest, they went through a lot more than me. I mean, my dad's been divorced twice, but my mum's been through like genuine traumas.
Yeah,
but they would never face up to that. Really, not really. Mm. You know, they'd be really ashamed to say that it affected them negatively. Yeah. They want to tell the world that they, you know, yeah, it was bad, but what do? You move on. Now, of course, kids get taught a lot more about mental health at school. My kids are always, you know, they got it coming out of their ears. The mental
health.
Well,
that's good.
That's
good.
That's very good. But one word that I hear coming up a great deal at the school is the notion of resilience, and I'm not sure how I feel about that, because that what you just said made more sense to me.
Sit with the emotions, absolutely.
Emotions, whereas resilience sometimes to
me
sounds
a brave
like
face on.
suck it up.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. No, I agree. I mean, I think, you know, that what is good about all of this is, you know, sometimes I, because of the work I do in family constellations, when I very first went to a family constellations workshop, I remember hearing, you know, all of this stuff, people seeing people's trauma played out and thinking to myself, oh my God, I've got four kids. Oh God, what have I done to them? Yeah, they're all going to be so messed up.
Right? Oh God, yeah.
But the good news is, you know, the more work you do, the less they have to do. You know, so all you writing this book, you talking about this stuff, that's such an incredible gift for them, because that means now this, that cycle can be broken. And that's what's so lovely about it. It really can.
My son's 11 and he's watched some of the interviews I've done.
Great.
You know, and I said to my wife, because like I've gone off to do a couple of TV things and they've watched at home. And I said, how did he feel about that? Did you check? Because I'm not sure, you know, especially when you're talking about things like drink and drugs. And she said that he was really just he was just excited and enthusiastic about me being on there and articulating it. And I felt that my daughter, I'm not sure, she's 15. And so I'm worried with her that she'll be like, oh God, what about my mates and all of this stuff? But I've talked to her a lot about it. And I talked to them a lot before the book came out. And said to them, look, just so you know, I'll be writing about this. And they knew that I hadn't drunk. And they sort of knew that I hadn't drunk since they were very small, because that I think they had the impression that I probably just was drinking too much. And that's why I decided to stop. But I had to go, well, actually, there was drugs and blah, blah, blah.
It's good, though, isn't it? Because it's honest. And you know what? Yeah. Whatever kids have to face, if parents are completely authentic, there's a real beauty in that. And some of that will have rubbed off on them. So I really do think, you know, I think it's great that you're talking about it. It's brilliant. Anyways, tell me a bit more about the so when you had your kind of wake up call, your light bulb moment, how did you reach out? What did you do to change what was going on?
Well, I remember the exact moment. It was the middle of the night and I was wide awake, not for the first time by any means. You know, drink and drugs would keep me awake and frantic and riddled with panic and self-hatred in the dead of night while my wife was asleep next to me and my kids were asleep in the next room. And I was lying there once again, having tried and failed for the umpteenth time to quit these bad habits, because I was way past really wanting them to continue. And that's how when people say, oh, how do you know when you've got a problem or you're an addict or whatever? I said, well, you know, people have got different definitions. For me, it's like, if your biggest desire is to stop drinking and yet you continuously drink anyway and then feel shit about it afterwards, that to me, I was just about rational enough to think, well, this is a severe problem, because every day, my biggest dream was to stop drinking and taking drugs. And yet every day I broke the promise to myself and the promise to my wife, because my wife had, although I was secretive by this stage, she was very aware of the drinking, if not the drugs. And so I was there in the middle of the night, and I think it was a stage of, I would literally do anything at this stage, right? Yeah. If someone had a magic wand to help me stop doing this. And I'd never, for all the reasons I've said, the whole kind of cynical Jack the Lad, don't take anything seriously. The idea of therapy had always been anathema to me. I thought, oh no, that's for navel gazers or hippies, and it's weird, and there's psychobabble and all of that. All those prejudices that lots of people have, particularly someone like me. I was like, oh, it's a load of old rubbish, that kind of nonsense. What I did was I Googled in the dead of night, because I just couldn't sleep. I Googled lying in bed on my phone, the Priory. Because the Priory was the only rehab place
everyone
knows. The other thing is, it's really near my house. So I drove past it all the time, right? And I thought, it's walking distance and I've heard of it. And they said there was like a free assessment. So I signed up for it there and then at probably like 3 a.m. in the morning. Finally got off to sleep and probably thought to myself, I'm never going to do this. But actually, I got a personal email from the sort of counsellor there the next day,
right,
saying, I've seen this, are you still interested, blah blah blah. And I thought, oh, it's not automated. I thought it'd all be automated. So I said, yeah, I remember I was in the office at work and I went, yeah, I will come. And I was so, like, I was almost like, when the email came through, I was almost like putting my arms around my computer screen, because I felt so, like, ashamed,
so exposed.
it was so touch and go. It's probably the biggest sliding doors moment in my entire life, because it was completely touch and go about whether I actually went or not. And on the day it came about, I happened not to be in the office. I was at home. I hadn't told my wife, hadn't told anyone. And I just jumped in the car. And I think part of it was like journalistic curiosity. I've always been a journalist, and I I do sometimes genuinely go into things, and in the past, very bad things, almost out of curiosity. Think, I've always heard about this, or I've read about it in books, or I've seen it in movies. I wonder what it's really like. So I went there out of that part. And I met this woman, and she just gave a free assessment. We sat there for about, I don't know, 45 minutes. And she told me to tell her everything that I'd done, you know, in terms of drinking and drug taking over the past just 7 days. And I was very honest. And she said a number of things that had a big impact, but one of them was, listen, okay, I think it's clear that you've got a problem. If you want to give up completely, we can help you. If you're looking to just cut down, I'm sorry, we can't help you. There's nothing. And I said, oh, wow. And it was very clear. It was completely clear. And I said, right, okay. And she went, so what I suggest you do is go off and think about that, and then come back if you decided that you are serious and you want to stop for good. And, you know, there was more to the conversation than that. But I can tell you, I left, and in the car on the way home, 10-minute drive home, I'd already decided. I loved the fact that she'd said that, because I'm an all or nothing person, like a lot of addicts are. And I thought, oh, yeah, I can really get behind that. I wasn't expecting that. But she's saying, quit for good, forever, a unilateral decision. Yeah. And I thought, yeah, that's the sort of thing that I'm quite good at. And I haven't had it. That was the last day I ever, I can't even remember if I'd had a drink that day, the morning before. I see, I might have done, because I was drinking in the day at that time. But I certainly have never had a drink since that. And that was like 7.5 years ago.
Right. And so did you actually go to the rehab?
I didn't go. No, I didn't go as an inpatient. She offered me that, and I just couldn't commit to it. Well, partly because I couldn't afford it
as well, isn't it?
I couldn't afford it. I mean, expensive. I was broke as a result, really, of my addictions, you know. I was broke, and also I just, like, it was for me with the kids and everything. I was just like, I need to try and do this another way.
Yeah.
But I carried on going back there weekly, and at certain periods, like 2 or 3 times weekly, to group meetings and one-to-one sessions with her. And she actually remains my therapist to this day. She's no longer at the Priory.
Right.
But she had a big impact on me, because she was a former addict herself.
Yeah.
She was very open about that right from the beginning.
Yeah.
And for me as well, she was great, because she was really smart and knew her stuff. And she was obviously very well qualified, but she told me that she'd been an addict herself, and said right at the beginning, listen, tell me everything, and I can tell you that however bad you think it is, I've probably done worse.
Heard it before, yeah.
Right? And I thought, but she said, I personally would have done worse.
Right.
But, you know, I don't know for certain. She went, but there's not many things I didn't do. So I was like, oh, okay. And she also, like, it's little things. She swore in our meeting.
Yeah.
Now, to me, that went a long way, I think, looking back. And I think that's why I think this stuff's all to do with language. I don't think, you know, you can read back to like the Stoics or Plato in ancient Greece, or you can listen to a fantastic podcast like this one, or get a brand new self-help book from Waterstones. The stuff that people are saying is very often the same.
Yeah.
It's all true, and it all makes sense, and it all works. The only difference is, and difference in my book or whatever all of us are doing, is just keep saying it in different ways and different languages, so it connects with different people.
Got to make it relatable.
That's what my book is. I know that there's guys like me going through similar things I did, and it's for them. If other people read it too, then great, I'll be delighted. But I'm just trying to tell the same story in a different in a different language, really.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So, how long have you been sober now, then?
7.5 years.
Wow.
Yeah, I'll be eight years in June. Yeah.
Yeah. And isn't it amazing how just every year it gets better? You know, there's not that flat thing. It's just, I absolutely love that. I just think it's amazing. So what happened for you then when you had to effectively step into a new identity? Because that's exactly what you would have had to have done, really step into this new identity of who you really are. Which, you know, I'm sure there's still plenty of positivity and fun, but you ain't the same guy, right? So how did you navigate that, because people can find that, you know, I find in my community that can sometimes floor people, because they, well, for starters, often people will find that they are not the person they thought they were. They thought they were really extrovert and completely, you know, party gal, party guy, but actually they're really quite introvert or even highly sensitive. So we have to kind of find our, I call it stepping into your sober shoes. Yeah. And there's a little bit of recalibration to be done there, isn't there?
Yeah, there's a lot. And I mean, I look back on my first 2-3 years of sobriety and think, oh my God, I was really quite mad. Right. I really was. I mean, I threw myself into work to an extent where I kind of wound up burning out all over again, you know. And
so was that in order to avoid social stuff?
Well, I realize that now. No, I think socially, I did go to ground a little bit for about, let's say, 6 months or something. I moved my seat football. By that stage in my life, a lot of my social life, because I had two kids, it wasn't like I was out clubbing.
Sure, no.
I was doing it, but my main social life revolved around going to football. I'd been going to football to watch West Ham with the same group of lads since I was an adolescent, right?
Yeah.
And that always surrounded football, drinking. And I distanced myself from that a bit. I carried on going to the football, but I switched seats. And I think, you know, a couple of mates might have thought that was a bit weird or resented it a bit, but they didn't realize at the time why I'd done it, because I was playing down my sobriety. Yeah. Like, I was being honest that I was sober, but when people asked, I was just sort of going, oh, you know,
I'm just doing off it for a while.
I'm sleeping better, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to discuss it or confront it. And, So, but then slowly I started kind of reintegrating with mates and finding that me personally, I know it's not the same for everyone, I was still able to go to the pub to see them and have a non-alcoholic drink.
Yeah.
And I was still able to join in the banter and have a laugh. Yeah. And lucky for me, I found that no friends really gave a shit, to be honest. I mean, you know, there was a couple of incidents with mates who I kind of ditched on the spot without telling them. I was like, that's that. Yeah.
There's usually like, some, isn't there, who you know you're only with them because you were drinking, and that's the only reason.
Well, there was that. I had a couple of mates who were very much, they were drinking and we were doing drugs together. And that was what the friendship was based around.
Yeah.
And it was easy for me to distance myself. And they were pretty, kind of, if I think about it, some of the comments they made were a bit sort of dismissive of what I was doing, which I realize, you know, in retrospect, is their own issues sort of thing, because they might have felt judged or whatever.
Sure.
And then I had another friend, an old friend from university. And I remember I was only like about 4 months sober. And, you know, we all went out in a kind of reunion thing. And I just remember her really calling me out in front of everyone and saying, I'm not accepting this. What happened? And my wife said, obviously something's happened and I want to know what it is. And you're hiding something and you've got a problem or you've done something. And anyway, the funny thing about that night was it was really upsetting. And I almost left the get together and was sort of talked back into staying. But the funny thing about that night was I remember her in the middle of this rant, she was so pissed herself that she fell off a chair, sprawled on the pub floor and then just got up and disappeared. And I don't think I've ever seen her since, because I was really upsetting, and it sort of informed a lot. You know, I've been on a journey way beyond just not drinking, a big human journey and emotional journey, and changed the way that I act towards other people a huge amount.
Yeah.
And I've learned a lot just about being sensitive towards other people and their choices, which, to be honest, was a negative part of the Jack the Lad image, where you sort of have a kind of an arrogance. You carry yourself as if you know it all.
Yeah.
And but those things that I mentioned, they're very isolated. For the most part, 90% of everyone I hung around with was kind of accepting, but not in a, oh, we think you're doing great, mate, well done. Just in a sort of totally indifferent, which is kind of what I wanted at that time.
That's what you want. Yeah, absolutely.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong? I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity. Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Yeah, you're right, because you know there's no doubt when you first sort of get out and about, your the fact that you've changed can shine a light on what's going on for other people. Mm. Clearly, you know, it's all being reflected back. But you're right as well in that if friends are your true mates, it doesn't really matter what you're putting in your mouth, does it? Well, why
no.
would it matter?
Really? I mean, I'm lucky. Some people, of course, don't like going to pubs at all, or they don't like being around drunken people. I've continued, so you know, I had a launch party for my book the other day. There was an open bar for the first couple of hours, quite a few people very tipsy. It really doesn't bother me, but I'm much stricter with just the way I just do things on my own terms more now.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And yeah. I try not to be selfish as such, but I guess I am a bit more selfish. I don't know if it's selfish though, is it?
Isn't it more about self-care? You know, because you're able to actually look at yourself and like yourself a bit when you stop drinking, and you can actually bring in that sense of self-esteem. So you know what good self-care is. And is setting boundaries, right?
Yeah,
you didn't have any of before.
No, you turn like up me. To things, you have a couple of drinks. Then you just leave. You don't care.
Exactly.
You don't dwell on, oh, maybe people will think I'm boring, or maybe people will think that. If anything, I think, well, I feel more confident than the other people in the room a lot of the time.
Totally,
and I'm very able when people say, do you want to do this? I'm very able with a smile on face, go, no. And they go, well, why not? And I go, I don't want to.
Yeah,
and I'll do it with a joke.
Saying no is an actual act of self-care. It really is.
It really is. And I also think it's so funny as well that you kind of like, I used to care so much about not being perceived as boring.
Yeah.
Now I celebrate it when I'm being boring.
Well, except that actually, you know, it's not true, is it? You know, it's actually drunk people that are boring, that woman
extremely.
You mentioned. That's what's
so
really
boring.
Exhaustingly boring. And actually, when people are sober and they have become all of who they are, then, you know, that is a really rich tapestry usually.
Yeah, absolutely.
So look, tell us what people will get from the book. What are the kind of key messages that you'd kind of like people to go away with, as well as enjoying your story? Because it's really nicely written. It's great fun.
Thank you. It is my story, I guess, but I try to offer the benefit and insights of my experience as I've gone along. And really, it's like I said at the beginning, it's like understanding that we're all human beings and everyone has the right to feel pain, and everyone will have definitely felt pain.
Yeah.
And actually, unless you have the confidence to look inwards a bit, and that doesn't mean you suddenly have to trade in your Jack the Lad card. It doesn't mean that you suddenly have to disappear, start wearing no shoes and socks, or disappear to a retreat in Tibet, unless that's what you want to do, which is also fine.
I'm talking
directly to my demographic, who I know, because I was like it once as well, will be put off at the idea of talking about their feelings, seeking therapy or help, going to groups, and just not drinking, because they think, oh, I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be weird. I don't want to be boring. And my message from this book is, it's not weird. It's not boring. It's very liberating. It's extremely liberating. It gives you, and you don't have to give up everything about your identity. I'm still at the football every week. I'm still having a laugh. I still make people laugh. They still make me laugh. I still have fun, but I've taken away all the bad bits. It's just like that. It's like you can keep the good bits that you want, and you get rid of the bad bits. And guess what? You will suddenly see really clearly what the bad bits are, because you couldn't see it before. You won't believe the amount of things that you currently do that in the cold light of sobriety actually are a rubbish waste of your time.
Totally, totally, you know? Absolutely, absolutely. I love it. So, and then just tell us a little about. So, you've got your Substack tell us what you write about on your Substack.
Well, it's called The Reset, and you can find it at samdelaney.substack.com, and it's very much what the book was born out of. In just before lockdown started, I decided to start writing about sobriety and mental health from a kind of bit more of a sort of a blokey point of view. And I did it because I'd written a couple of pieces. I've been a like writer journalist my whole career for like 26 years, 27 years. And I've written all sorts of different things, but I'd never done much self-reflection. I'd often been preoccupied with trying to make people laugh or telling other people's stories. I'd written a couple of pieces in The Guardian where they'd asked me to write, touch upon my own sobriety.
Yeah.
And the response I'd got had been enormous and really encouraging. And the main thing that I heard from people was that it was anyone who knew me, they knew my writing or they'd seen me on or heard me on TV or radio. They kind of had this image of me as a nonstop sort of joke a minute sort of a bloke. And they were very, and the reason me suddenly being a bit more reflective in print about the fact that I gave up drinking, that was linked to my mental health.
Yeah.
It was just such a surprise. It was a shock. It felt like a bizarre juxtaposition, right?
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, the fact that I am the way I am means that the things I'm saying have extra impact.
Totally. Right?
Because I'm the last person you're expecting it from. So yeah. I thought, well, that's really great and really powerful. And I also thought, and actually, the more I do it, the better I feel.
Yeah.
So I thought I'm going to start writing a Substack because I didn't feel completely comfortable with the writer-editor dynamic when I was writing things that were so personal. Because when you're writing very, very personally, you know, an editor, quite understandably, I've been on that side of the dynamic myself, will have their own agenda or
Absolutely.
Boxes.
And
I think that's fine. I'm a professional writer. I'm fine with that dynamic. But when I'm writing about things that are extremely personal, so I thought I'm going to do it as a newsletter. And it built up quite quickly and I got quite a few thousand subscribers. And then I started doing a weekly podcast that was linked to it. It's also called The Reset, where I interviewed other interesting guys about their experiences. And I tried to tap into the same sort of, set of experiences or people who you wouldn't expect to usually talk about. So my first guests were like Sean Ryder, the pop star, Chris Reiner, SAS soldier, footballers, these kind of guys, undercover cops, guys who were sort of like... tough guys, lads, this sort of thing, you wouldn't expect it, and all opening up very honestly.
So
it grew, and that's really what the book came from, because I carried on doing it quite consistently. It built an audience, and in the end it came to the attention of a publisher who thought it would make a good book, and I'm delighted they did, because now it's found a wider audience.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I love it. Thank you so much, Sam. I really appreciate you sharing it with us, and you know, I think it's just great. And you know, I mean, not we haven't even said, but it goes without saying, really, that one of the really great things about this book is that you are bringing out into the open the undeniable link between, alcohol and addictions and poor mental health. And it's
absolutely
not talked about enough. You know, it really isn't. I mean, you know, still anyone listening to this podcast knows that I bang on about it the whole time. But, you know, certainly with my community, the number of people that sort of rock up to GPs and get and are given antidepressants, but without being asked if they're drinking, it's still going
amazing.
On. All the time.
That happened to
and
me.
That
yeah,
has
absolutely.
To stop. Did it? Oh my god.
Yeah, I mean, when I was taking lots of cocaine, drinking all the time, and taking prescription meds for my mental health all at once.
Nobody ever bothers to ask how that's going to play out.
God. I did say. I remember going to GP at one point, and it was where they do you a checkup when you're 40. I'm 47 now, and so it would have been just a few months before I give up. And I was kind of looking for help, and it was a nurse, and they weigh you in. Because they do a big sort of MOT in the NHS when you're 40. And they weighed me. And she said, she said something like, you weigh 2 stone heavier than the last time we weighed you here, which was X number of years ago. She went, that's bad. And I went to her, yeah, the thing is, she went, why is that? And I said, well, the thing is, I'm really drinking a lot. And she went, are you? And I went, yeah, I think I'm drinking too much. She went, well.
So am I.
No, she just went, well, you better stop then. And that was the end of that.
That's helpful.
I mean, I don't blame her. You know, she's not there as an, she was a nurse. She's not there as an alcohol addiction specialist. But it's like, it's funny because you sort of are sending little signs, but in the build up to me,
no, absolutely. That would have been you actually reaching out for help
and hoping that swoop in. But then
imagine if she'd have said that, but imagine if she'd have said, listen, well, I'm not the person to help you, but you know what? Fantastic that you've noticed that. I'm going to signpost you to someone who can inspire you to stop drinking. That's all she needed to say, right?
That's
how we need to change it.
We do, and
well done you, because you know you're raising more awareness of that, so that you know, so that it's going to be easier for other people to look within and reach out, right? So
yeah, I would always say don't try and white knuckle it, because
no,
I know people quite close to me who I've seen give up drink because they knew it was having a negative impact on their life, and despite me trying to reach out, there's only so much I feel comfortable doing with people, because you know, saying, listen, you need a program. It doesn't necessarily have to be AA or this or that. I'm not prescriptive about what it is, but you need something.
Yeah. Well, you need connection.
You need connection.
Is very, very important.
That's it. You can't just stop and think, well, my life will be exactly the same, just minus alcohol.
Yeah, because exactly.
I don't believe that's sustainable.
It's about so much more than just not drinking, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah.
So I love the book, Sam Delaney, Sort Your Head Out, Mental Health Without All the Bollocks. And you told us about Substack. So thank you so much. I'll put the link in the show notes. And I really appreciate it, Sam. I hope we get to meet at some point. Really
yeah,
nice
I hope
to
so you. Too. I really appreciate you having me on. Thank you so much for being so kind about the book. Lovely to
Cheers,
meet you.
Thank you. You've been listening to the Natural Health and Sobriety Show on UK Health Radio.